Hello and welcome back to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm here today with Graham Davis, news editor.
Hello, John.
And Mark Robinson, who is our sectors and features editor.
Hello, John.
How are you doing?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Very well,
good,
thanks.
Good.
And how are you?
I'm wonderful. It's been another busy week. It's bargain shares week, and we'll be speaking to Simon Thompson later about his picks for this year. But at the moment, all eyes are on Greece. Or more specifically, Greece is the word. Yanis Varoufakis, and I'm sorry if I've offended anyone there with my pronunciation, who's been touring Europe this week.
In an amazing leather coat.
In an amazing leather coat. And so all eyes are on Greece, and it's kind of wreaking a bit of havoc with the markets because nobody's really sure what's going to happen. I mean, Graham, you've got a bit on this in the 7 days section.
Yes.
Give us a bit of background.
Yeah, well, Yanis Varoufakis arrived. Well, he's done the tour this week, basically. He was in London on Tuesday. Meeting George Osborne,
and he left his coat there as well.
He left his coat in
which
he appeared to leave his
a symbol of goodwill
leather jacket in number 11 Downing Street.
Yeah,
but markets rose quite sharply on Tuesday. Everybody thought, you know, maybe there's going to be some sort of agreement here. Obviously, since then he's then gone on and had a chat with the Germans, and that hasn't gone so well.
So I guess at first everyone was so before Syriza. Got elected, everyone was worried that they were going to be this kind of hardline left-wing party with some very extreme views on the way that Greece should tackle its debt burden with the Troika.
Yeah, the libertarian Marxist.
Libertarian Marxists.
Yeah.
Well, that's Yanis Varoufakis. He's an academic, and you know, he's not a stupid guy. I mean, this is not a party to be underestimated.
Yeah.
So everyone was very concerned when they got elected, and then less concerned earlier this week when it seemed that they were prepared to be somewhat conciliatory in
their approach. Yes, they're not calling for debt cancellation, which was a lot of the rhetoric in the election campaign was about. He came with what appeared to be an acceptable plan, in his opinion anyway, for rolling the debt over into some perpetual bonds and all some other bonds that were linked to economic growth.
Yeah.
So, you know, sharing the burden a little bit, but it was definitely more conciliatory than people had thought it would be.
And there's quite a few people who think this solution is quite a good one, that these perpetual bonds and the GDP-linked bonds are actually quite a good idea, including, I think, it was the Adam Smith Institute who came out in support of this plan. And I think Yanis Varoufakis was apparently gobsmacked that he had received the blessing of the Adam Smith Institute as a kind of a left-wing academic.
Yeah, I mean, in economic theory, it could work.
Yeah,
but in political reality, the Germans don't seem to want to budge on this. And apparently, they've had a press conference today, at which the German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble and
good pronunciation,
thank you,
yeah,
and Mr. Varoufakis Mr. Schäuble said they'd agreed to disagree, and Mr. Varoufakis said they hadn't even agreed to disagree. So it looks like they're poles apart at the moment on that. The Greeks are sort of just saying they need time and they want some sort of bridging program in place now. And the Germans they're not budging at the moment by the looks of things.
And the ECB did something with Greek debt today as well. Graham, have I thrown you with this one?
They've given a directive to the banks, haven't they?
They can't be used as collateral, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which raises great concerns over their ability to raise money.
Well, exactly. And their ability to make short-term funding sort of commitments, state funding commitments. Mm.
So ECB turning the screw, which isn't very helpful. And, you know, I think a lot of people out there are saying, well, you know, why not give them a bit of time?
Yes.
This plan doesn't seem that ludicrous. Greece has some crippling problems to overcome. And I before we came into to the studio, I thought I'm going to have a quick peek at unemployment rates across Europe, for one thing. And this is something that Greece topped the bill on. Have a guess what the unemployment rate in Greece is. Don't look at my piece.
I can't
read
your paper from here, John.
I'd say something in the region of 25.3%.
I go 32.
It's 25.7%. Well done, Robert. Your eyesight isn't fading. Just...
Well, I presume that's general unemployment. That doesn't point to youth unemployment.
I read a stat that youth unemployment in Greece was 60%.
Good Lord.
60%. Mm. So, you know, it's not that ludicrous that someone in Greece wants to do something that's outside of the economic conventions that seem to have well, the performed
the
in Europe.
The point is, all of the ECB are playing hardball, which it seems that they are doing. I mean, this is going to give support to other movements throughout Europe. We noted some sort of fairly large-scale public demonstrations in Madrid this week as well.
Yeah, yep. So that's in support of Podemos.
Podemos.
I don't know what a pronunciation of that is like. But again, it's another left-wing party headed by a left-wing academic, anti-austerity. And, you know, actually, Spain has the second highest unemployment in Europe. Can you guess what that is?
Something less than, say, 25.96% or...
Well done, Rob. You're on fire today. It's 23.9%. So, you know, these are countries grappling with some serious problems.
Pretty painful problems, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And problems that affect the youth more, as you rightly pointed out, Mark, the youth more than the rest of the population. And, you know, whilst it's easy to point the finger at Greece and say, well, you know, they've had years of profligacy and overspending, and, you know, it's not the generation of yesterday that's going to suffer, it's the generation of tomorrow. And, you know, I find it quite extraordinary that for politics we are willing to heap misery on these countries. I have to say that's a personal view. That's not a magazine.
And they have had years of misery now.
Yes,
the last four or 5 years. So
absolutely,
we shall see. I mean, who knows? The Germans look like they don't want to give an inch at the moment, but they may just have to at some point.
Absolutely. Well, so you know, I mean, my editorial actually covers this subject. My view is, I think, you know, certainly as markets were bounding ahead earlier this week, my view was, well, they're kind of underestimating the potential disruption that this could cause as you know, the success or failure of the negotiations pan out. And I think some people are even talking about a Greek exit from the euro at some point. And some people are even talking about a German exit at the other extreme.
Well, there does. I mean, you know, markets are still treating this relatively complacently, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's come back to Greece in a week or so when we know a little bit more what's going to happen.
It's not going to go away.
What else has been going on this week, Graham?
Commodities and oil continue to sort of dominate as well. We've had a bit of a rebound in the oil price, I think, since the beginning of the year. I think it's dropped off again the last day or so.
It pulled back about $8 in about a week or so.
I mean, it's had quite a dramatic recovery. This may be, some people are suggesting, it could signal the bottom. It might just be short covering, you know, but I think a lot of the weight of selling has gone out of it for the time being.
Yeah, and there were some conciliatory statements coming out of Riyadh as well, which helped to sort of calm markets a bit.
And have there been any moves? Well, there's been some more moves on production and capex. We've had a couple of the majors reporting this week that there's going to be more cuts to capital spending in the current year.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that everyone had been expecting, really, but... it was quite an interesting through the results that I was looking at this week, because rather than the capex question, and everyone sort
and
of
who paid, who was reporting this week, just out of interest? Oh,
well,
we
had BP and we got BG and Shell in the magazine as well, because these tend to report early in the cycle as well. So and they provide a bit of a pointer. And I think Chevron have announced as well over in the States. And as I say, the moves on the capex weren't any great surprise, and in fact, a lot of these sort of strategies have been in place for some time now. But the interesting thing, when I was looking at this week with BP and Shell as well, is the paucity of their reserves replacement ratio. Because it's a factor as well, while they're cutting back on these capital and exploration budgets and selling off supposedly non-core assets, they're not replenishing their sort of reserve base. And that's fine for a year or two, but it's obviously unsustainable over the long run. And they were rather low this year as well. I think both of them in the low 60s. I might be wrong on that, but it was, I think, the three-year average was about 62%. And, of course, that is unsustainable over a longer period of time. So it would be interesting to see what happens over the coming months. My guess is that there's going to be a lot of cheap oil and gas assets out there. So rather than go down the exploration route, the standard exploration appraisal route, we're going to see a lot of these big super majors, even though they're looking after their capital flows, but you see them coming into the market for smaller companies that are already in production and some fields that are moving towards production as well.
Because a bit of consolidation coming in the sector.
Yeah, I've got no doubt about it. I'm going to cover this in the magazine in coming weeks as well, but it's quite interesting. It's almost like a sort of perfect conditions. I mean, I reiterate the point that they are, the capitalist discipline is their top priority at the moment, but there's going to be some sort of knockdown distressed assets out there, and so we're going to see some action on that, I think.
Okay, and you know, without that new production, new exploration coming on,
they have to.
Your overall supply is not growing as fast as it otherwise would be.
Well, that's right.
Which is supportive of the price, presumably.
Well, it will be over the long term. Yeah. I mean, it's like any other market; it self corrects after a time. But obviously, with oil and gas markets, it's like, you know, turning around the proverbial super tanker. There was an interesting point in BP's announcement this week as well, is that industry analysts had been expecting a loss linked to, or a poorer result linked to its Rosneft stake, which is near 20%. In the event, I haven't got the figure in front of me, but I think it was a $470 million profit. That's a preliminary figure, though. The BP's manager put this as a preliminary figure, and there was a change to the way in which Rosneft looks at their overseas assets as well. So come audit, that may no longer be the case. So we've had on a sell for a while because of the uncertainty over the Rosneft stake, and of course the open-ended sort of fine linked to the Macondo well. It's not exactly open-ended now, but it's still hasn't been defined really. But we're still slightly wary over this, because we wouldn't be surprised at some point in the future that there might be sort of further bad news on that Russian stake
from Russia.
Yeah.
You would imagine Rosneft's not having a great time of it.
Yeah, well, exactly.
There's no sign of any sort of improvement in Russia's situation either.
Well, that's right. But you know, as ever, the shares are getting some support, because you look at it now and it's got a yield of nearly 5.5% at the moment. Both BP and Shell are pretty cheap in relation to the sector as well. But
we're buyers of Shell.
We are buyers of Shell, but that's purely because we think that they're long term. Their dividend it's got better coverage for their dividend long term.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a sort of an income play, really. We could make a strong case for BP as well, but it would be errant to sort of to put them on a buy at the moment, because there's just so much uncertainty. You know, our readers are intelligent enough to make up their own minds in this regard, but certainly, we think the uncertainties outweigh the positives of the stock at the present time.
We don't seem to. I mean, with Greece dominating the headlines, you know, we haven't been looking in the direction of Ukraine quite so much in the last few weeks. But I'm pretty sure that situation there is not getting any better.
It appears to be escalating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's a mission Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande
They're off to Moscow, aren't they?
They're off to Moscow to see the big man. See what happens there.
So, yeah, lots of risk mounting, but markets almost hit a record high this week, despite
they were heading that way on Tuesday. It's calmed down a little bit since then. But
okay, so, I mean, you've also been talking this week, Mark, you wrote the news spotlight this week, which is again about commodities. The theme of this podcast in the past few weeks has been that falling commodity prices, falling oil prices, can be good for the economy. By injecting a little bit of competitiveness into things, you know, your expenditure goes down as a household or a producer of manufactured goods. You're not so sure.
Well, I mean, there's plenty of evidence, historical evidence, to suggest this is the case. When we've had, you know, quite a steep fall in oil prices before, there seems to be a broader economic benefit. But it does take a little while to filter through into the wider economy. But we haven't seen a great deal yet, certainly not in Europe as well. I think this is brought home by the case of Germany, Europe's most important economy, which is now in sort of deflationary mode. And this apparently was all linked to energy prices, which again were linked to oil prices there, which have reduced household costs there by about 9% or so. And so we're not seeing that sort of action. And furthermore, I think there's sort of other implications. I think we did mention in one of the other podcasts that the World Bank bank had sort of made a forecast for this year that the major nine commodity groupings will contract again this year, according to them, which is sort of a very unusual occurrence. And there's there's some evidence that investors have sort of got in the market in the early part of this year, but
in commodities.
Well, yes, there's some forward-dated commodities, but, I mean, it might be a short-run thing. We've seen a little bit bounce in the oil price this week.
Copper bounced a bit this week, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It did. But, I mean, we've got to see these things over the long run. I make the point in this piece, the main point of the article anyway, was saying that there are sort of unforeseen risks. And, of course, it's been highlighted in the last couple of months or so by Standard Chartered, who's taken a fairly hefty impairment on their books linked to their commodity exposure. And I looked at it a little bit closely, and apparently there are any number of large-scale banks in Asia that have significant exposure in this regard. And of course, if markets were to keep on deteriorating, then at some point these debts may crystalline,
Actually, we've got a John Barron's Investment Trust portfolio in the magazine this week, amongst a bumper crop of features. I think there's four this week for the first time ever, I think, four main features. John has cut some of his exposure to biotech after a very good run, but he's topped up a couple of his commodity-related investment trust holdings. I mean, he hasn't explained why this month. That is next month's column, but you know, this echoes something we were talking about last week, that there are some people who are starting to think we may have seen the worst of the commodities sector.
Well, yeah, I made a point a couple of weeks ago about I guess it's situational as well with a lot of commodities. I was making the point about copper markets at the moment, and that's quite an interesting one as well, because it's all linked to the fact that we don't really have a clear understanding of inventory levels in China. And there's other sort of
elements. We never have.
We never have. Mm. We never have. And yet I keep on looking out for official statistics from Beijing as well. It's situational, and there are certain markets, I think, like copper over the long run, which we're actually quite positive on. But, we'll have to take it in a case-by-case basis as well.
OK, well, let's have a look at the chart of the week this week, which is the Baltic Dry Index. And we used to talk about
it's
this quite a lot.
Favorite, yeah.
It is an old favourite. We used to talk about this quite a lot in the wake of the banking collapse in 2008. Mm. We haven't talked about it so much recently, but this week's chart is it warrants a mention because it's looking pretty ugly.
Yes.
Which of you guys put this together? It was Mark?
It was a joint effort.
But 60% slump in the past 3 months. Baltic Dry Index is basically a shipping index for shipping.
It's bulk commodities.
Bulk commodities.
Yeah. So we're looking at iron ore, coal, these type of things.
So that kind of ties in with what we've just been talking about in terms of a slump in commodity demand.
And a good lead indicator of global trade.
Absolutely. But the bigger worry is that this is telling us something about the future. That's bad.
Yeah. Well, what do we say here? It is at its lowest since 1986.
That's right. And there, I had another quote here from the Clarkson, the ship broker, that was saying that seaborne trade of coal and iron ore into China will be the growth rate will be 6% this year, but that's coming down from a growth rate of 8.7%, and that translates into huge seaborne tonnage. Mm. And there's got to be some sort of implication there.
Mm. Yeah. No wonder the Aussies cut their interest rates this week.
This is right. In fact, where my father lives in Newcastle, he sees all those sort of tankers lining up to take the thermal coal away, and he's even mentioned to me that the numbers are down.
There you go, nice bit of scuttlebutt there, all the way from Australia. Fantastic, fantastic. And of course, we spoke a couple of weeks back about some Chinese GDP figures, which were starting to slow. Mm. But I read this week, and I can't remember who it was that said it, but there are mounting concerns that Chinese growth could slump a bit more quickly than perhaps we're forecasting at the moment.
Well, the Chinese Central Bank has just today announced that it's reduced the capital ratio requirement for the banks there by 0.5%. That doesn't sound an awful lot, but it equates to something like 81 billion US. Mm. It's one of the standard sort of monetary levers.
Yeah.
So it shows that they're worried as well. Mm. And you look at the lending, the internal sort of lending figures for China this could sort of, again, link to commodity price weakness. This could potentially dry up as a result of it. So, I mean, you know, we're not out of the woods.
No, we're certainly not. But nevertheless, markets march higher.
Onwards and upwards.
Onwards and upwards. Indeed. Onwards and upwards. I mean, there's been some other interesting stories this week. We've got a big feature on Apple that's written by Theron Mohammed, which I think we introed last week, mentioned that we were going to write this. Yeah. But there's something I noticed in 7 days here, Graham. It's issuing some bonds. Is this right?
Yes, borrowing to return money to investors.
Well, it has to do that because it's the only way it could get the money back into the US.
Yes, because there's another piece in 7 days there on President Obama's plans to tax overseas profits. But yes, no, Apple's taken advantage of its soaring reputation at the moment and demand for exposure by its launched $6.5 billion bond issue, which was massively oversubscribed at low rates.
They're not that low. I think they're pretty generous. I mean, considering we're talking about Apple, you know, 1.6%, which is the lowest rate, that's not bad. No, we saw some
historical corporate borrowing costs. They're pretty low.
So we saw a Nestle corporate bond this week slipping into negative territory. And there's certainly some government bonds that are now
we're talking about Finland went being one of them. Territory, yes. The European bond market.
Well, Germany's 5-year bonds, didn't they?
Yeah, they're short. They're short dated. They're all short dated bonds. And I guess that's partly in anticipation of bond buying, which is going to be coming from the ECB very shortly.
Next month.
There's a bit of arbitrage to be had there. But no, I read a piece in the FT this morning. You know, we've been in a ZERP world, zero interest rate policy world. We're now in a NERP world, which is tremendous, but not so tremendous if you're looking for income. If you're a pension fund manager trying to match your liabilities, it's pretty tough out there.
Actually, speaking of income, in this week's Sector Focus, Emma Power, one of our new writers, has highlighted some of the benefits of the water utilities, because Ofwat have come through with their sort of determinations and they're broadly favourable, and so these companies have done particularly well over the last year. They've got a little bit of momentum, and yet they're still sort of yielding around about 4.5% as well. So it's a low risk option for investors, really.
And they've been good performers, share price wise, for a while. I mean, they've beaten the market quite comfortably over the last few months.
They've been strong.
The principal risk factor attached to them is the role of the regulator and government sort of intervention as well. But now this has been clarified, I think a lot of our readers might be looking at them from an income perspective, certainly.
And I think there's an M&A angle on that story as well.
Yes. Apparently there's there's been interest in the past as well. And of course, what the determinations do, they give some clarity in terms of the potential distribution and also the leverage for these companies as well. So once this has been clarified, we might see some interest from private equity as ever, but also different types of utilities from abroad, sovereign wealth funds perhaps.
And sovereign wealth funds and pension funds have bought these sort of assets before, haven't they?
Yep.
Okay. Then we've got the stock screen as well. While we're on the subject of income, again, it's Algy publishes this one once a year. He calls it his inflation buster screen. But given that there is no inflation, he doesn't have to work very hard. But it's actually quite a good performer, and this year has thrown up a few dividend growers, which we like. You know, it's often been said that you shouldn't just chase pure yield; you should chase companies that are increasing their dividend. So even if it looks quite low to start with, as long as that there is the scope to increase it quite quickly, that's perhaps what you should be looking out for. So, have a look at that. Interesting stuff. Some results starting to pick up this week as well. And I know that there's one of my favourites in there, which has had quite a good week, Ocado.
Yes. Who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
Finally made a profit.
That it's finally made a profit after 15 years. 15 years. My view would be that it only made a profit because it put together quite a favourable deal with Morrisons. But there you go. That's just my view. I have always been somewhat of a bear on this company, so So, perhaps I shouldn't be listened to when it comes to Ocado.
But you see, now they're profitable. We do have a PE ratio on that company.
And what's the PE ratio?
They're now trading on over 200 times this year's earnings.
Ooh, bargain.
And forward PE ratio of 345 times.
Absolute bargain.
So, yeah, make of that what you will. But, yeah. You know, it's well, you could say it's early days, but as you said, 15 years to make a profit.
And Mark, you've recently got yourself on the booze, haven't you?
I have got myself on the booze, as it happens.
You're covering the beverages sector.
Exactly. Yeah. Poor old Julia Bradshaw is so weighed down by her lot that this has been slung in my direction. There's only a few players in there, of course, but I looked at Diageo this week, who's sort of the world's biggest spirits fund. As usual, it was a fairly decent set of results, but there's sort of regional weakness slipping in here. There's spirit sales for some of their chief brands down in North America as well. Plus, there's been a fall away in their growth markets in China as well, with brands like Johnny Walker down by about 15%, I think.
And that's to do with this clampdown on luxury gift giving, partly.
Partly to do it, certainly in the case of China, but in America, I think, from what I was looking at anyway, it seems there's been a change in consumer taste there. People are moving away from clear spirits onto darker spirits and specialist distillations as well. Plenty of our readers will with a sort of decent issue, 2.7%, plenty of people will continue to hold it within their portfolios. It's a sort of a buy and forget sort of stock in many respects.
Absolutely. It's got good brands, and there's certainly a lot of fund managers out there who, you know, Nick Train is one of them who you know, he espouses holding on to companies with strong brands forever, basically. It's not a bad strategy. Okay, well, that's probably enough from the magazine this week. Now I think it's a good time to have a chat with Simon Thompson about this year's much anticipated bargain shares portfolio. Hello, Simon.
Hello, John.
How are you?
Very, very well, thank you.
Good. So, you've been working very hard over the last, well, it must have taken you ages to research this, because it took me a while to read it. We've managed to squeeze it into 12 pages of the magazine, which is a huge feature. How long did it take you?
It took me about 3.5 weeks, John, to do. It's about 10,000 words in total.
Wow.
I've covered 20 companies, created a portfolio of 2015 bargain shares, and that's about 7,000 words for that part of the feature. So it's a huge amount of research.
Indeed. I mean, we have to keep this thing under lock and key as well, because everybody awaits the annual bargain shares with bated breath. Simon, first of all, tell us how it works. What are the bargain shares? What's the strategy you're using here?
It's actually very simple, John. It's a balance sheet approach to investing. All I'm looking for is companies where the net current assets, less all liabilities, exceeds the market cap of the company. It's literally that simple. And I've been doing this for the best part of 16 years, and in 12 of those 16 years, the portfolio has actually beaten the market. And actually, if you'd held the shares for the first 12 months after each portfolio is actually produced, the average return is about 22%.
I thought you'd actually written 22.7%. You're rounding down, so I'm
rounding down. Go on.
Doing yourself out of that crucial 0.7. I mean, that's pretty impressive. I mean, it's beaten the market, you know, as you say, quite substantially in most years that you've run it. Last year was a bit tough.
Yeah, last year was very tough, simply because the AIM index fell round about 19% during the 12-month holding period.
Mm.
And the portfolio shares is all small cap stocks, or a large percentage of them were small cap stocks. So there's basically no hiding. I also made, perhaps in hindsight, not the best decision to actually invest in some Chinese companies, given that sentiment towards AIM-listed Chinese companies has been pretty negative over the last 12 months.
Mm.
But I think the thing worth bearing in mind is not necessarily the years when the portfolio makes these great returns, but the years when it doesn't, it actually does pay to hold on. For example, in 2011, when the portfolio underperformed that year, it's actually gone on to rise quite substantially since. And if you're actually holding that portfolio now, so just a buy and hold strategy, you're actually up over 51%.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, is there a way that you would suggest people play this? Do you buy the entire portfolio? I mean, is it something that you would expect people to play within a discrete 1 year time frame, or you know, would you suggest that people run them for the long term? Or do you treat it on a case by case basis?
I take it on a case by case basis. I mean, during the great years, some of the gains have been stupendous, and some of the shares I've actually researched and included, and it's obviously tempting to take profits when a share goes up 100 or 200%, which some of the companies have. But equally, when you're actually buying a portfolio, and there's 10 stocks in the 2015 bargain share portfolio, when you're actually buying a portfolio, you can actually take the hit on a small number of losses because the gains on the others will actually compensate for it. So my advice to readers is to actually run it as a portfolio and buy a fair number of the shares, and if you can, buy all of them.
Mm. And then keep going if the fundamentals, if the investment case still stacks up at the end of the holding period.
Absolutely.
And you do, I mean, you keep us updated on the portfolio throughout the year, so, you know, if anything happens, I mean, for example, this year, you know, when we did start to see some weakness in some of the Chinese companies you mentioned, you know, you acted reasonably quickly there to limit some of the damage.
I did. I mean, the point that readers should bear in mind is that his portfolio is for a 12-month holding period, but I will, throughout the year, update each and every company on a regular basis, so at least readers can actually keep in contact with what's happening to those specific companies.
Mm, absolutely. So one question, I mean, you know, markets have had, not so much small cap markets, but certainly markets generally have had a good run. Have you found it more difficult to find what you would determine as bargain shares in, you know, this year?
I find it easier this year than last year, simply because the small cap stocks took such a big hit over the last 12 months. So out of the companies, I'm looking at the list at the moment of the 10 companies I've chosen for this year's portfolio. There's one with a market capitalization of $435 million, another $144 million, another around about $200 million. But the rest of the companies generally are south of $100 million market cap, so focused on the smaller end of the market. But these are liquid companies, so you can buy them quite easily. But no, to answer your question, I've actually found it easier this year.
That's good. So plenty of choice. I mean, presumably you've had to whittle some out. You've whittled it down. It looks like a pretty solid portfolio to me. Certainly no Chinese companies in there this year, Chinese AIM-listed companies.
No, all these companies are UK companies, UK-listed, UK head office. Yes, some have some overseas exposure. There's an engineer in there. That does have a number of large multinational companies with overseas operations as clients.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of these companies are UK-based companies, so should benefit from the dynamics of the UK economy, which is still pretty strong. We're still in recovery mode, and you know, GDP growth in the UK last year was you know, the highest in the G7, and it's still expected to be pretty good this year. So you've got the domestic economic recovery behind a number of these companies offering a pretty good tailwind. But yes, they do have some overseas exposure for some of them, which is actually helpful as well, given what we've seen with the currency effects with the US dollar against sterling. So I've taken a macro view on some of the stocks I've actually selected by looking at the currency markets and also other overseas economies and seeing where I think value can be added to these companies and lead to earnings upgrade cycles as the year progresses.
Mm. I noticed something else as well. I mean, you know, so 9 of the 10 are from AIM. But some of these companies, they, you know, AIM has a reputation as being a place for risky young companies, but some of the companies you've chosen this year have been around for quite some time.
Oh, absolutely. I've got companies that have been around for over 100, 150 years for some of them. Although they are actually listed on the AIM market, that was a decision of the board of the companies to actually move from the main board to the AIM market a few years ago. But no, these are solid companies without any doubt, and I'm really happy with the way this portfolio has been put together, and I'm actually quite excited by the prospects over the next 12 months.
Absolutely, I quite agree. Looks great. Okay, Simon, well, that's brilliant. Thanks for talking to us. We won't give away the 10 just yet. If you want to find out what the bargain shares are, you'll have to either subscribe or head out to the shops to buy them. But anyway, thank you, Simon, and we'll catch up again soon. Okay, so that's all we have time for this week. Thank you very much for joining us all again. Thanks to Graham and thanks to Mark for their valuable contributions today, and for Simon, of course, for dialing in from sunny Kent to talk through the bargain shares portfolio. There's plenty more in the magazine, despite the fact that it's 12 pages of it are filled up with bargain shares. As I said, there's four features. We've got even more features throughout the funds and your money section. So fantastic value this week, £4.50, all good news agents. Thanks again and speak soon. Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.